This episode is sponsored by Hacksoft, your Django development partner beyond code. More on their services later in the show. Hi, welcome to Django Chat, a podcast on the Django Web Framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined as ever by Carlton Gibson. Hello, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
And we're very pleased to welcome back Frank Wiles, who should need no introduction. He is a partner at RevSys. He was the boss of the Django creators, your former president of the Django Software Foundation. We could spend half the show talking about what you've done, but we're pleased that you're with us, Frank. Thank you for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. One correction there, I was not their boss.
Oh, what?
I was their coworker. Yeah, I was their coworker. I actually worked in a different department.
Oh, right, because you weren't working on Python, but I thought you're doing Lisp, right?
No,
Perl.
It's Perl.
Well,
one or other.
You take a shot. Oh, okay. So not the direct man, but you were there, but you're older than they are.
I'm older than them, and I had more ops experience, and so they would rely on me to help with like performance things and database backup things and stuff like that.
And Jacob is still a partner. Jacob Kaplan-Moss is still a partner in RevSys. Okay. Well, a lot to talk about, but maybe we were before we started filming, admiring your setup, and you were mentioning, giving us a little bit of the history of the designers on Django, because, there's sort of three people who get credit, but there were a lot of people involved, yourself included. What about on the design angle, right? Is this more focused on the admin, or could you... You mentioned a couple of names that may be worth a shout out in terms of.
Yeah. And I talked about like a lot of this history in my last DjangoCon talk.
Yes, too. We will link to that. Yep.
Yeah, that's a good one to link to because it goes into much deeper detail. But yeah, so when Django was getting started, there was, as most web shops had, somebody who was kind of focused on the design, and that was Wilson Miner. And he was pretty much responsible for designing the Django template system, like from the user API side of it. And then, the initial website and the Django admin, all of that original design. And it's held up for 20 years. I mean, we've touched it up a bit here and there and modernized some things. But for the most part, it's still the way it was 20 years ago. And then after that, Brian Veloso and then Don Gazit both had roles in kind of pushing design elements, through Django in the early days.
Yeah.
When we were talking before, you used the phrase design BDFL, right? So the benevolent dictator for life.
Yeah, so there was a brief time where there was like, Jacob and Adrian were BDFLs of Django, and they sort of had kind of, I think it was somewhat unofficial, but like we sort of like, you're the design BDFL. We're gonna defer to you on all design things.
So the thing I wanted to pick up on that is, do you think we need that again or something similar? Because when I was fellowing, we'd get these design issues come in, and that was both on the website and on the admin. We'd be like paralyzed because we're backendies. We've got this design neurosis, right? And no one could kind of make a decision. Yeah. But do you feel that if we could put one or two people or three people in that kind of role, it would help us drive forward a bit?
I think it wouldn't be a horrible idea, but I don't know that we have that many design issues that come up, month to month. I think that if we had a group of designers who were involved in Django in any capacity, and we could kind of point to and say, hey, would you give us a couple of ideas? And maybe the steering council could just pick up, here's two ideas that, steering council picks, right? I don't know if we really need a design committee or anything, but it's not the worst idea for any, by any means.
Well, I would say we could use a design/marketing BDFL, because DjangoProject.com, we don't need to go all into all that, but there have been multiple attempts with lots of time spent by very talented volunteers to update that. And because what is Django? It's the admin, it's the little rocket, and really it's DjangoProject.com. And I think that's that's what's kind of holding us back in terms of, it looks like it hasn't been updated in a while because it hasn't.
Well, it just got a bit of a refresh.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah,
I don't.
People are working on it, but
I hear you.
If you came in right 2025 or 2024 or 2023, you would you know, change it.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, on one hand, that probably means that we're more focused on code and releases and features than you know, Flash. Yeah. But, and we're obviously succeeding despite it. But, I, you know, that would definitely
well, it's like
not
that uncanny think... Valley, right? It's not like as ugly as Simon mm-hmm. Willison's website where you go, oh, this is either a noob or like a pro, right? It's like somewhere yeah. in between. Like this, that's the problem. Don't be in between.
Yeah. No, I've often thought that I'm kind of surprised that like an up and coming designer has not approached Simon about dataset and saying, hey, like I will do this for you, but like I just want some credit, right? Like I've always kind of wondered, because I mean, dataset works great, like it's fine, like, but it's very, you know, designed by programmer, right? And you know, I don't think I'd do much better, right? But you know. But it's one of those things where like I'm kind of surprised somebody hasn't reached out. Maybe they have, and maybe he's like, eh, just, you know, like it's the feature's not the look, right? But yeah, no, I mean, design's obviously important. One of the things, you know, that we've as a community have gotten right is docs, and you know that they're readable at least, right? Like, you know, that they don't, you know, they look good. They're not just tech, you know, black text on white background. That they're organized well and searchable and all those kinds of things. And that's huge for Django's ability to get picked up by people.
Mm. And then, you know, we beat this dead horse, but, you know, the community is, I'd say, ultimately what we got right. I'm not going to put myself in yeah. the we there, but that others have gotten right. You know, even looking around, as much as it's nice to think, oh, I wish we had a benevolent dictator kind of thing, you know, look at WordPress, look at Material, right? Where you have, you know, one person can have whatever sort of mental health crisis they're having and just blow up an entire thing. Mm-hmm. And
absolutely.
Yeah. So that's a...
And I think that, yeah, that's the danger, right? Like, or even not even blow it up, but just lose interest or lose focus.
Yeah, or, lose interest, you know, or, I mean, or alienate. Yeah, right. You don't have to fully... I mean, the Material thing is wild. I don't know if you followed that at all, where the it just
I
like suddenly
that one. I followed the WordPress one with popcorn, yeah. And just like, you know, it's just like everything you could do to shoot your community in the foot, right? Like as a masterclass. Right.
And someone who, you know, up until that point had about as good a reputation as you can have too, right? Which is partly why it's so strange.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been a WordPress user, really, and you know, because early days they had lots of security and update
issues.
We'll
put early days in quotes there.
Well, yeah, and
I have
so,
to use it for some stuff now.
Yeah, and I don't, you know, and I, it's gotten way, way, way better. Like, don't get me wrong, but you know, I just never got into that world, and all of my CMS needs, even with clients, I've been able to do with Django. And it was obviously home, and so like I wouldn't look elsewhere, but yeah, I don't understand how, you know, well, really anybody in a powerful tech position that is making really good money, for some definition of really good money, I don't understand when they go for the money grab, right? If, you know, just any pick large tech CEO, I don't understand when it's like, oh, okay, this means I'm going to make 1% less money, so I'm going to make this horrible decision. I just don't understand it. Like, I don't understand why they don't just retire and have boat drinks, you know?
Is that not because the sort of when you're so desensitized to the world that all that's left is the graph? All you can see is the graph going up or down, and down is not acceptable.
I guess I get that on some level, you know, like I always wondered about like Bill Gates, right? Like when he was at the height of things, I was like, why are you still doing this? Why aren't you, you know, playing golf or whatever it is you enjoy, yeah. right? And it turns out, like, you know, I watched a documentary and read a little more about him kind of personally. And what he enjoys is that thinking through the problems. And he basically structured his job and his role at Microsoft for years to, he wasn't in HR meetings about 401k bullshit, right? He was just there talking about like, what is the next, you know, what is the next focus and what is the cool tech that we're doing in R&D and helping steer that. And I could see that still being fun, right? But yeah, I don't get when somebody's like, oh, well, I could make 1% more money and I'm already loaded. I just don't
I think
get
you
it.
Just go insane yeah. at a certain point with too much. power and surrounded by yes men and women. I mean, I think we've seen this is the history of the world, right? I mean, so Carlton, you're the philosopher. What do you?
Well, no, well, okay. Well, I am not going to answer that. That's just crazy. I want to bring it back. But Frank, so you've got as long a view of Django as you have, and we were talking there about BDF sales and the BDFL model perhaps going wrong at times, and Django's community model is very strong. But sometimes we have, not sometimes, quite often we feel that we go too slowly because of it. And it feels like there's a trade-off. That, like, you've got these two obvious models, and one of them, they've each got their downsides. Are there obvious things that you think, or not obvious things, are there things with your sort of long view of Django that you'd think, do you know, we can speed up there, we can change that, we could perhaps do this?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely been points over time where it's like, oh, man, like you know, like we've been discussing in the steering council about elevating the visibility of third-party packages. Anybody in the community knows that half of Django's strength is the ability to grab third-party packages to solve the problem that you're facing, or the you know, something like Django storages to store you know, files in S3, for example. Like, you know, that's one of those things that, you know, a lot of people are like, why isn't this in core? And it, you know, it's so that it doesn't have to move slow, right? Like, just, you know, the same kind of core is where things go to die, like from the Python world. It's not quite true, but there's no good reason that it has to come in, right? And so it's better to be out, and, you know, fellows can only do so much and maintain so much. But there's so many times that I've run into people that they're like, they're unaware of that. Like, they're doing their own S3 file handling by hand with Bodo, because they just don't know Django storages existed, and they've never heard of Django packages or Awesome Django or Jazz Band or any of the things that, like, everybody who's really plugged into the community knows, and not even really plugged into the community. I just mean, like, you know, barely plugged into the community.
Well, it's in the official tutorial now. Like, there's a link to finally. But yeah, I agree. I mean, it's. Yeah.
Right. And so like, one of the things the steering council is doing that Carlton and I are on is trying to help elevate that a little bit, and making it a little more acceptable. There was always this feeling like, well, Django shouldn't pick winners here. And
I still think that to an extent, right? I mean, like, we've got three or four CMS solutions. I don't want to say that CMS solution. Yeah. I want to tell you about.
Right. I have my favorite. I have the one I steer clients towards. The others are fine. They're just not for me. Right. Like, I like certain features of this versus that. I like, you know, the amount of work I have to do to achieve what it is I want to achieve with different libraries. You know, there's certain ones, like, Carlton, you maintain some that are great that I don't use.
You're not allowed to not use them.
but there's a lot that, you know, I do use, right? Like, and so, like, it just depends on, like, what, you know, what kind of thing I'm doing. I don't do a lot of form stuff because most of our projects of late have been API stuff. So I don't have a lot of need for libraries related to forms, you know. Right. And so, like, that's, you know, that doesn't mean that they're bad. Like, and that doesn't mean that everybody should do React front ends, you know, by any means. But yeah, like, just the fact that, like, we all know that there's this handful of libraries that are the top for this category and this handful for the top for this category. And if anybody asked us, we would list them off the top of our head. The fact that they're not that visible to the wider community is, I think, holding Django back a little bit. Because, you know, like we talk about with WordPress, the thing about WordPress is you can get a plugin to do anything. Nobody necessarily knows that about Django, right? As when they walk in the door.
Well, I've long thought, since I need to do videos of, like, a third party Thursdays, because I mean, part of it is, you know, those of us, it's like, we're like, it's out there. Like, we're doing stuff, you know, like, they're like the Awesome Django repo that I, you know, manage with Jeff Triplett, your partner. We just hit 10,000 stars, you know, Django packages, which Jeff now runs with help, gets a lot of traffic, but yeah, still
people, a lot of traffic. Yeah.
Still people don't know about these things, or even if they do, they want some degree of curation, which makes sense, right? You can't just go by recency and stars. And if you don't have, you know, a podcast where you can lob these questions to guests, how do you?
Well, like, you just mentioned, like, having a, you know, third party Thursdays. Like, when I first, you know, got involved in using Django as a developer and not just friends of the founders, One of the things that I found really valuable was Python module of the week.
Yes.
And it exposed me very, you know, slowly, but over time to standard library modules that I didn't know that existed. And that's partly because I came from a Perl world where there wasn't that much of a standard library compared to Python. Python's standard library is probably 4 or 5x the size of Perl's, where at the time CPAN was way larger than the cheese shop way back then, right? And so you knew to you always had a handful of third-party packages in a Perl project, where that just wasn't as common with Django or with Python, which is why like early Django had no dependencies, right? And still only has what, just
3 or 4
PyTZ basically. Yeah, it's just a handful. Yeah.
Well, you need that kind of. You need the interest. Okay, you can't give someone the interest, but you need that drip function, right? Like maybe I should do a newsletter.
There's your year's worth of videos.
Like a Django, Django app of the week or whatever, right? I thought about doing that a couple of times that I just sadly haven't had time.
Well,
right?
Because I think, we could link to it, you know, on the forum, I put a post, I've done some posts and Jeff has actually helped, you know, try to do some PyPI statistics, which we can debate how accurate those are, but, you know, some version of like, top tens. I feel like that's a perennial thing. Like I'd love to get, you know, just the top tens that people are using, because I invariably find stuff that way.
Well, and Mike, Carlton and I ended up talking about this a couple weeks ago. I've always had this idea of basically creating a FICO-like score for software packages and libraries where
go ahead. Yeah.
Somebody, me and a small group come up with, here are the factors that matter, but the factors are kept close hold so that you
can't
gain
them, baby.
Right. Cause you. And not like in a way to make money off of it, but just in a, here's the, you know, I don't know, the Frank score for, you know,
it's
got to
be called the Prank score. It's got to be called the Prank score.
Yeah. And then if you over time learn to trust the Frank score, then you can trust future Frank scores on other things, right? And I think that could be a way, you know, like I haven't had time to do it, obviously, but I have some ideas of things like, you know, around velocity of you know, issues versus pull requests versus releases, like things that are a little deeper, you know, downloads obviously factor in there, not just stars, but like things that would be not impossible, but more difficult to gain.
You have like a 6 credit score, a 6-8 factor model. Right. We probably end up at this relatively the same place on that, but that would be what one would do,
right? And maybe expand it to other systems too, right? Like it doesn't, not just Python or not just Django, but you know, JavaScript and Debian packages and you know, like Rust crates or whatever. But yeah,
JavaScript packages is a nice one, because as a Django developer, what you want is the sort of the recommendation for JavaScript packages, which are kind of Django adjacent, rather than dropping you right into the, you know, the pickle barrel.
Yeah. Well, and then like the other thing I think that happens too is often there's a new, you know, kid on the block that is dramatically better than the, you know, the status quo. And many of us find it and use it and know, and talk amongst ourselves, oh, this is so much, like, you know, this is, and it's ready. It's ready for prime time. It's, you know, but people are slow to adjust to it. And I think one of the things that we wanted to talk about, like one good example of this is UV.
Right.
Yeah, let's do it.
You know, like, you know, tried out UV, like, you know, first couple of weeks, a little rocky, couple of features I needed, couldn't use it for all projects. But like very quickly, within a couple of months, we were switching most of our projects to it. And now I don't even know if we have a project where I fully get to decide what's used that isn't UV. And that's been in like less than a year, right?
It's only been out
how much
a year.
Of that? Yeah, just a year. It was February when it came out. I've been doing my research, Carlton, because
good. Well done.
PyCharm has UV support. And so at PyCon US, I spent the morning, we're doing some stuff around that. Now, of course, you know, support, we can make it better, but we have built-in tools and I suspect other IDEs will as well. But I wanted to ask you, Frank, so for a greenfield project, sure. One of the things is, how do you decide, you know, switching over to it from a more legacy project. You must have some battle stories on that.
That's the thing, is it really? Don't. It takes me, it, you know, 15 minutes and we're switched over to UV and CI and everything.
Wow.
Right? Like, we had one project where there was like a weird, we were accidentally and didn't even know it, relying on kind of an old dependency resolution to get the packages we needed. And that might have taken me half an hour to sort out that I need to pin this one, you know, like to figure out which is the one that I, you know, the dependency of the dependency of the dependency that I needed to pin to not cause the test failure. Like, that took me a little bit, but like most projects, it's been put UV in front of your pip commands in local stuff and in your Docker file and in your CI and you're done.
Well, and that's the thing is it's, you know, Charlie Marsh, the creator, was making the point that it's not just fast. It's so fast that it changes how you do things. Like, for example, things that were written, the CI, you can put into pre-commit as one example. Yeah. I'm curious, are there any other ones like that you've found since you've, you know, been using it a bunch?
No, I mean, like we
are you using that one, for example? Are you?
I'm not using that all over the place. Jeff just kind of tuned me into that a couple of months ago. And so I haven't gone back and done that to some projects. But yeah, it's so incredibly fast that, like, you know, like I think it was Sebastian from Fast API said, he was like, I had to double check that it actually ran.
Yes.
Right. Like, and that's, you know, that's, and that might've been for Ruff. I might be getting that quote wrong. That might've been for Ruff, but like, you know, that's, it is, it changes your workflow, right? Like I went from, you know, like Ruff on save, right? I run Ruff every time I save, and I save habitually. Like,
yeah. I use Ruff like every pre-commit and just, yeah, I don't even think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's yeah. I save every time I stop to think, right? In my editor.
Five times a day.
And yeah, more like five times a minute. but yeah, no, I oversave for sure. But I lost 2 weeks of work once, and I've never forgotten it. 20 years ago.
Oh man,
I still have my editor configured to create a timestamp backup of every save, and so there'll be like 4 minute, mm-hmm. 5 minute of them. But the number of times over the years that I've gone in, found the version that had the exact thing that I deleted and saved me, it's worth having it.
Well, it's sort of like you know, Git branches being cheap changed how we all worked. Like Subversion, creating a branch might be go get a sandwich on a, you know, large legacy project, right? And, you know, and Git makes it instant. And so you create lots of small branches. And UV changes, yeah, like I'll just install stuff, you know, to play with it and then get rid of it. And I'm not even concerned with how much time that's going to take, right?
Well, in some IDE, sorry, Carlton, one last point. Oh, I was just going to say some.
You do yours in them.
Thank you. Some IDEs as well, you know, PyCharm is an example. VS Code has this. I'm sure others do have, you know, a local history kind of thing, which is basically like you don't have to configure it yourself, but it will save a lot of things for you so that hopefully, broadly speaking, losing stuff is a lot harder now than it was, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. The other aspect of that, I think, is that like cycle time is super important to flow, right? I talk about this a lot, especially with clients, that, you know, if your CI is 2 minutes, that's amazing. That's great. 1 minute, 30 seconds is even better. And focusing in on that, right? How long your tests run, right? That ability to just iterate and try. Well, let me try that. Nope. Let me try that. If trying something means 30 minutes, you start to debate your choices. You maybe pick the wrong one, right? Instead of try all three, right? You lose flow, you lose your place. Naturally, our brains are, you know, you're on Reddit all of a sudden and you're like, how the hell did I get here? Right? You know, you're texting your wife, you're checking your
total
stock portfolio,
waste of time,
whatever. Yeah, no, not a waste of time, but like you just get distracted because, you know, it's like we're compiling. And so like, let's go get coffee, right? Like that slows everything down. And so if I can, you know, construct the scenario and iterate on it in, you know, increments of, you know, single digit minutes, I can just plow through stuff But if it's double digit minutes, I'm walking through stuff. Right?
Yeah, and getting in, like, you know, when you're working on something and you've got exactly the test that you need, and it, you can just run it. Yeah, okay.
Problem solved in 15 minutes instead of all day.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Hacksoft is your development partner beyond code. From custom software development to consulting, team augmentation, or opening an office in Bulgaria, they're ready to take your project to the next level. Well, and that was in the UI. Okay, I'm sorry, Carlton. This promise last one. I was just going to make the point that in UI UX stuff, this is back a number of years. They did the research on, I forget how many, like hundreds of a second it was, but if the page took a little bit more on Amazon.com, the percentage of people just like leaving went, you know, so just a clear speed, you know, and it just, yeah, just if it pauses you at all, you know, and I think it's even worse as a programmer because you're trying to be in a flow state. You're trying to like have the tools take care of themselves, not get in the way.
Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, I spent, you know, a large part of yesterday shaving 100 milliseconds off an e-commerce.
No, it's all right. It's fine.
Right. Like, and, you know, and it's one of those things that, you know, people are like, oh, it's fast enough. And it's like, it could be a little faster. Like, let me spend a couple hours here and shave that off. Because, yeah, the research has shown you can feel 100 milliseconds.
Okay, I'm done, Carlton. Go.
Okay. No, I was just going to swing back to the example you hit was one of these cases where UV doesn't handle the sort of legacy resolving algorithm. And what's interesting, you said you've only hit that once. And I wonder if like PIP itself could sort of use the much faster algorithms. Yes, UV's written in Rust, but a lot of it is to do with the caching and the different algorithm that's used, not necessarily just the fact that it's in Rust. And I wonder if PIP could sort of implement the more optimistic algorithm and only fall back to the legacy slow one if that failed, because I think there's performance being left on the table.
They did make a change, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. But I do think that, like, I think they did make a change because there was a PIP change where you could say, like, use the legacy resolver in PIP a while back. And I think I may have basically leapfrogged that problem with UV before, like, I would have run into it with PIP. But you're right. They may be able to do that. And I would imagine, you know, they're going to strive for a little more performance parity with UV, but I don't think they're ever going to really get there of Rust, right? And I don't know, you know, sure. Like, I think we should always have some competition in tools, right? Because it makes everything better. But I think that, you know, for the foreseeable future, UV is going to win, you know. But the minute somebody comes up with something that's twice as fast in Dart or whatever, like, I'm gonna use that. You know, I don't quite understand people's concern about the switching cost on this, because I've yet to have the switch take more than an hour for large projects and microservice projects. And like, I mean, like, it does not take very long. And then the other argument I've heard people make is that, like, because it has some VC backing, like, what happens when they pull the rug? And I jokingly said on social media, I was like, well, then we'll fork it and call it VU and, you know, like, and run with it for a year before we really have issues, and somebody will come along and maintain that, or they'll come up with a new one and we'll switch to it, and it'll take me another 15 minutes in years down the road. Like, I mean, I don't expect Charlie and the Astral team to do that. You know, I think that they've got other ways to make money. But even if they were, like, the switching cost is so small, you know, it's not like switching from Python to Rust or something, right? Like, this is a pretty small piece of the puzzle of your stack. Like, it's a very important part, but it's a pretty small one to switch, really, right? Switching testing libraries would be weeks of work, right? Or switching from Django to something else would be weeks and months of work for most projects. But like, switching how you install your PIP packages, like, just like moving to Docker, right? Like, might take you a whole day if you don't know anything about Docker, right? Might take you 2 or 3 days if you know nothing about Docker. But like, now I can move a project from not Docker to Docker in an hour, right?
Most of that's finding your template and Docker file to copy across. Yeah.
Exactly. And knowing kind of, you know, like I already understand how layers work and what I need to do. And that one time I ran into the libgdal problem with yep. You know, like that, you know, that kind of stuff that is because I do this a lot, right? And I do this a lot for lots of projects where most people have a project or two that they change once or twice a year. So it probably feels harder, but honestly, like it's really not. It's really not that big a deal, most of these sorts of changes, right?
So good. So you said you're still mainly doing REST APIs and, you know, React front ends in front of that. Is that's still the case? You haven't swung into the HTMX world and
not as much. The rest of my team does that more, mostly because most of my team doesn't know JavaScript very well. And so it's much easier. And it depends on the project, obviously. Like, you know, we've talked about this. Like, we have some projects where, you know, there's, you know, it's a large site, 100,000 lines of code. There's 7 elements that kind of need that reactive slickness to it that HTMX can provide. And so HTMX is perfect for that sort of thing. Or even just a little bit of vanilla JavaScript, right? Like, that's perfectly acceptable for those kinds of projects. And it's the sort of projects that members of my team that don't know JavaScript can do, or I can jump in and do those little bits, right? But then we have other ones where it's like, I've got, you know, it's a full-fledged desktop app, but in a browser. And those, you know, in so far in my experience, are easier for me to do in React at this point. And, you know, I'm sad to say that I'm almost faster with JSX these days than I am Django templates, which really surprises me. But I still occasionally get tripped up on something in a Django template that I remember from years ago. Oh yeah, I remember you gotta do that, here. And then yeah. Like, but it'll trip me up for 5 minutes, right? And where like I'm in flow with JSX these days, so like I've moved my personal blog to Astro, simply because it supports MDX, which is Markdown with JSX components in it, and that seems to be the sweet spot for me and like simple blog like websites.
Okay, so from that perspective, what's, because you know, one thing that always comes up as well is Django's front end story or lack of front end story. And you know, if you're just using it with sort of the old-fashioned Django way, static files does everything. You maybe got Django compressor to, you know, combine your JavaScript files or whatever. From a React kind of point of view, what integrations or what things would you like to see that, you know, help Django integrate with the more, you know, Next.js, Astro, React worlds?
I think we've already got it, really. You know, Django Webpack Loader, Django Vite, basically take care of it. You know, if you're starting a new project, definitely use Vite, Vite.js. It's a bundler and transpiler and does all those pieces for you. That's much, much simpler than Webpack, but just as powerful and quite a bit faster, honestly. Most of our projects have moved from Webpack to Vite. As the next time we need to touch them. And it's install a Django app, toss it in installed apps, load a Django template tag in your base template, and that you're integrated. Like, that's it. Like, there's nothing more to do. So I don't know that we need any tighter integration than that, except maybe, you know, if 5 years down the line, Vite is the de facto only way to do that in the JavaScript world, which I would find hard to believe any one thing to be the de facto way. Maybe that gets pulled into core just because it, you know, it's a small project, right? It's not going to be a large lift to maintain. But I think that we really dodged a bullet as a framework, not picking one, because the JavaScript ecosystem has moved so fast, right? Like, If we had picked what was before React that started Bulma? With a B.
Oh, no, that's CSS.
Oh, it's driving me nuts. Keep wanting to say Basecamp.
No, I keep wanting to say Bootstrap. It's not Bootstrap. It's
I just had to move somebody off of it a couple years ago, but we'll find it
Backbone.
And put it in the
Backbone.
Thank you.
Backbone. Yes. Backbone was the hotness around the time this kind of started, you know, in jQuery and like, let's bundle these, let's make a better front end story. And we'd still be having to support Backbone, which basically no one uses. And then moving off of it would be, oh, well, now I've broken, you know, like I can't upgrade to Django, you know, 2.2 because it doesn't support Backbone anymore, you know, and we'd be playing that game every couple of LTS releases as JavaScript changes, right? And even as much as I think, you know, there's merit to bringing HTMX in, I think that we might look in 10 years, assuming Django's still around, you know, knock on wood, but that we'd regret that decision, right? And like I said, the integration is small. It's like, I don't know, it's sort of like, should we bring UV into Django? Like, you know, we're only going to work with this. Like, I don't think we need that. I think that, you know, a couple of good blog posts, a couple of good doc posts, you know, pages in the documentation of how to do this and show that it's 15 minutes and you're running. I don't know that we need to.
So again, it's that lack of messaging more than the what's actually there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. I'm going to give you some messaging. Tell me about Cube Anypod because you just released this. Let's go.
Yes. So it's my second real Kubernetes related CLI tool written in Rust. The other one is called Kube Secrets. It's a little tool that removes an annoyance I have with working with Kubernetes all day. And that is, you know, one of the benefits of Kubernetes is that your pods, which are one or more containers that run together, have very randomized-ish names. And so, but you often want to just pop into one of them and check, is the Django setting set to what I think it is, right? Like, I've set the environment variable. I'm pretty sure that, you know, debug is off, but I want to pop in and double check.
You just hit a URL, right? That doesn't exist, right?
Well, yeah, that's one way. But But like, you know, that's the sort of thing I'm talking about. It's like, I just need to pop in. I need to run this management command that, you know, resets some situation or does some batch processing or something that I need to do. And so the first thing I have to do is say, tell me the list of the current pods, and then I have to cut and paste one of those to pop into it. We also have a pattern we use with just the command runner to exec into a pod, take a snapshot of the database, copy it local, and restore it into our local compose environment, because often it's very convenient to grab a copy of production, bring it local to debug a certain situation instead of trying to, you know, scaffold that situation's data correctly to debug it. And that also, I need to know a pod name to exec into it, to take the backup and bring it down. And so that finally annoyed me enough that I built a little tool that just, you give it a string prefix of the deployment or stateful set that you've got there, and it comes back with any one of, like, the first pod name it finds. And or execs you into the first pod that it finds. And so it's a little bitty tool, but it's one of those that I probably do that 10 times a day. And so it's, you know, now that it's one easy command and not two or three commands is very nice. You know, there's other tools that make some of that a little easier sometimes, like K9S. If you're doing Kubernetes and you don't know about K9S, definitely look that up. It's like top for Kubernetes. Gives you a super easy access to getting a shell in a container, or getting the logs, or seeing the definition of the pod's YAML, seeing memory and CPU usage statistics and things. It's a great little window into your kube cluster. But yeah, that's one of those. It's also a Claude success story. I know enough Rust, but it would have probably taken me all afternoon, if not all day, to get it right. And then I thought, you know, I'm going to do this in Python, but like, let me just try Claude with Rust. And about 30 minutes later, it was working. And about 30 more minutes, I had it polished. And then I spent about an hour on, you know, the README and the docs. And then Claude helped me set up the GitHub Actions to do the multi-architecture build for Linux, Intel, and ARM, Mac, and Windows, and just automate that as part of the release process. So if I push a tag, it builds and releases binaries for everybody, which was great. And so, yeah, 2 hours, I had my tool, and that's just amazing.
we've got to ask you then about LLMs. You're obviously enjoying using Claude, and you know they make a big difference, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do. In you know, used smartly, they're not perfect, right? You got to, you know, you need to have tests. You need to kind of understand what it is you're trying to accomplish. They do hallucinate things, but often it's very apparent. They're trying to pip install a library that doesn't exist, something like that, you know, like, and you can quickly say, oh, no, use this library, and then it's no longer confused, right? I find them super useful 90% of the time. About 10% of the time, I'm just like, I get frustrated, I know what I need to do, and I've tried to prompt twice, and it's, you know what, it's going to take me 15 minutes, but I'm just going to code this part because I know what needs to happen, right? But where I found it'd be super useful, like Claude Desktop, for I am confused about this situation. Like I see this, I'm getting this error message, I think that's this, but blah, blah, blah. And it comes back with an answer, usually in an area that I'm not super familiar with. Like I had an FMMPEG issue converting some video for a client that I was getting this weird header error out of FMMPEG. And then I had no idea what was going wrong. And what it ended up being was the file name suffix was telling me it was one codec, but the file was actually a different codec. So somewhere in my code or my stack, it was appending a suffix that didn't match. And so I was telling it to convert from A to B, and it really wasn't A. And that, and you know, and it just didn't give me a good error message saying, hey, you said this was WebM, but it's actually MP4, right? Instead, it just said, you know, header error at byte zero, you know, something, something. And I'm like, what? And it worked for 300 of the 306 users that had done it that day, but those six had a problem. And I just was sure it was something deeper than that, right? And so I overlooked it. But it quickly said, like, double check the file type. And I'm like, yeah, let me do that. And I pulled it down. It's like, oh, this is an MP4. Like, it's, you know, probably saved me two hours of debugging by just pointing
FMMPEG
in that direction.
An FMMPEG is a perfect example, because the API on that, or the user interface on that, is so big that no human could ever master it. Whereas, you know, an LLM can be like, no, you need these options.
Well, I find it really great for, like, these tools, like AnyPod. That thing I've always wanted, but I haven't found a Saturday afternoon free enough, you know, that I felt like spending building it. I can often build it in 30 minutes, a really rough version, not one I would release to others, but something that does what I need real quick in a virtual environment on my laptop, maybe never even makes it to GitHub, right? Like just a throwaway tool. And, you know, I get a lot of situations with clients where they're like, they'll give me an email that says, hey, we noticed there's this problem with these 93 records. Here are the UUID primary keys of them. And I have to like cut and paste them into something, turn them into a Python list to fix them, right? And I can take the whole email, select all, paste it into Claude, say, hey, see those UUIDs? Turn them into a Python list for me. And 2 seconds later, I've got a Python list, and then I can cut and paste that into my shell or whatever, you know, into my code and take care of it from there. And if nothing else, it's saving me some carpal tunnel, right? Like, you know, like I just put in quotes, you know, I can do it with my editor. I can do the regex that'll put quotes on the front and quotes in the commas on the end. And like, I can do it pretty quick. I've done it for years, but I can't do it as quick as an LLM.
Yeah, no, good. In Mythical Man Month, there's this graph where it's like works on my machine. And then to get it into a product, it's like times three. And to get it into something you can actually sell, times three again. Whereas if you just want that down the bottom, you can get it done, you know. You don't need all those refinements.
Oh, yeah. Well, even just thinking about, like, I know what options I want. I know what defaults I want. I don't have to think through or provide a way for you to do your defaults, Carlton. Like, I can just do what I want the way I need it, only taking into consideration my scenario, you know. Like, I can hard code things to a Kubernetes cluster name that you could never do.
In a tool,
you know,
in a real tool. Yeah, yeah.
In the real world, right? In a real tool, yeah.
Yeah,
Simon, go on.
I was just going to say, I find them fantastically useful for those, you know, finding a missed comma or dumping in a whole bunch of stuff. And I guess, I was trying to think about it. It's sort of error checking that for whatever reason, other error tools that we have don't pick up. You know, the framework doesn't pick up or Python doesn't pick up. And and so hopefully that's something where I remember back when I was way back getting started, you know, if I missed a comma or something, that could be days of my life. And now, you know, even for a beginner, I think that's a very appropriate use case to just dump it in and see what it spits out, because it's there. They are so good at spotting those things.
Well, and as a rubber ducking debugger, right? Like, we've all had that experience where, like, we're just not sure what's going wrong, and we end up talking to a colleague about the problem, and maybe even they don't even say anything. About halfway through our conversation, we come up with what the possible answer is. But this is somebody I can talk to about it at 2 o'clock in the morning if I'm up with some insomnia, right? And, you know, hey, Claude, you know, what are you doing? You know, and, but
select chatty mode. Right?
And, yeah, exactly. But, you know, and you know, and then tools like Aider, I'm a big fan of Aider at this point, because I can really control what context goes to Claude that helps focus the answer I get back, right? Like, here's the model you need, here's the view you need, here's the test you need. Like, write me another test, but that checks these two scenarios. Do it in the style of the existing tests that are there. And it basically spits out a test like I would write it, using the fixtures that I've provided and everything. And I don't have to do much to it. And it's great. And it costs you 1 cent sometimes. You know,
yeah, Jeff is going on and on about this to me and on the socials. Sorry, Carlton, one last one. How exactly do you have it set up? Because, right, like, you people can use these within IDEs. You can use the desktop app. You can use the web app. You can CLI it up, you know, with Simon's tools. Like, what's your particular poison?
So a little bit of all of it. So if it's the random question, like that FFmpeg thing, I'm Claude desktop. I just paste the error in and say, this is what I'm trying to do. This is the error I'm getting. Can you give me some hints as to what maybe the problem might be? And, you know, it spits back some stuff, and maybe there's a follow-up question or two, right? And I just kind of have a thread about that. Sometimes it's just, I forget the best way to iterate through a list of lists. Can you show me an example? And it will spit out a little example that I can basically cut and paste into my code. If it's, I'm writing a test, or I'm wanting you to add a feature to, you know, some code, I'm probably using Aider to do that. And then a little bit of like Pydantic AI or something like Simon's LLM tool. If I'm building something that's a little more reusable, right? Like, one of the things that I often, when I write a blog post, for whatever reason, it'll take me an hour to write the blog post, and then I'll spend an hour agonizing about how to summarize it for the tweet and for the meta description tag. Like, what's the, you know, like, it'll take me almost as much time to do that as to write the post. And so now I ask Claude or ChatGPT, here's the post, give me 10 headlines, 10 tweets, 10 summaries of this. And I kind of pick and choose from there. Oh, I like that wording, but maybe not that whole sentence. Like, let me put those two. And then I'm done in 5 minutes or 10 minutes instead of an hour. And so I have that.
And it's worth it to avoid the agony, right?
Right.
Well, it is interesting, like the cutoff for when, you know, so you have a monthly subscription, and then when are you willing to pay, you know, pennies, dollars?
I think people would be very surprised how little it costs. So when I first started using Aider, you know, and Claude, they gave me $5 of free credit or whatever. And I thought, okay, well, I'm probably going to burn through that really quickly. So I threw $20 in. And then I was using Aider, and it even shows you, like, how much was this last prompt? How much have you spent this session? So you can kind of keep track of what's happening. And then I ran into an API limit, and I saw something Simon had said that basically people who spend more get a little bit higher API limits. So I threw another $100 in. That was in December, and like, so 125 total from December. And I think I'm down to like $118 of credit, right? Like, now I'm not using it 8 hours a day or anything, but I'm probably using it at least 30 minutes a day, if not an hour, on the Aider API side where you're paying, right? And like, I'll have, you know, any pod cost me
a dollar. Yeah, and it was worth it, right?
Right. It was a dollar. I got the tool I wanted in an hour for a dollar, right? Now, is it the best Rust in the world? Absolutely not, right? Could I dry it up a little bit? Absolutely. I even had it go through, and because it was really not dry, the first version. And so I had it dry itself up a little bit. And, but still, I see some stuff in there that I'm like, oh, okay, like this should really be a function that just takes a workload. And like, you know, but like, I'm just going to leave it. Like, it's like 600 lines of Rust. Like, I don't really care, right? It does the job. And also, I had to get home to dinner, right? And so, you know, maybe someday I'll pick that back up. But yeah, like some of the things, you know, like we're really approaching a time where you can build real software in a day for $10, right? If you're an experienced programmer, I'm not trying to say that in a way that like, right, that's me prompting along, right? Knowing exactly what I want, how I want it architected. It's just, it's saving me from the, oh, I missed a comma, the agonizing of what am I going to name this function? You know, like it just puts it there. And then I look and I'm like, you know, that's a perfectly appropriate name, right? Or it's not. And I change it, right? That variable message, you know, that comment is confusing. Let me change it. Or it's wrong. You know, I can focus on the parts that the higher value stuff, right? Just like I don't write code in assembly, right? I could, like, you know, I learned it at one point enough to build a little dumb calculator, right? But like, I wouldn't want to work in that all day. I'd be doing something else. I'd be a lawyer or something. I don't know. But that, you know, that's the low level. But the higher level of stuff still takes thought and effort and experience and everything. And you know, I don't care if Claude gets three times as good as it is right now. My wife is not going to build great software with it, right? Perfectly capable of building those throwaway tools that work for me, right? But for a, you know, the idea that anytime in the next 10 years, Amazon is going to have, you know, 10 high school kids and they're going to maintain Amazon software is just insane.
We have it in the U.S. government at the moment.
Well, and it's working really well so far, as we can see.
Just jokingly here, it seems like there's a good empirical experiment going on. For years, they've said less government. Well, they're testing that. And everyone else is just going to sit back and see. It's in the name of science.
Yeah. I mean, it is an experiment. This may be one that we look back on and think should have been an illegal experiment. But, we've experimented on people, in ways that weren't ethical in the past and have learned from it. And I think this is going to be one of those case studies in the future of how not to do things.
Well, likely. The thing that I'm hopeful for with these LLMs is that, you know, they open up kind of, let's call it automate the boring stuff with Python's or build a job blog with Django level skills to almost everyone. Like, is, you know, and they're not quite there yet. And the blog won't quite work or the script won't quite work first out of the thing. But there'll be an awful lot of people that have access to basic software skills, which currently don't. That's going to be a major changer.
I mean, you know, I've been around for a while. I'm kind of old for a techie at this point. And, when I was in middle school, I was the computer nerd because I knew how to use a word processor. And in high school, I was the Uber nerd because I knew about the internet and I had an email address, right? And those things are, my kids have that stuff now, right? And it, like, you know, they're doing it on an iPad and it's second nature. Like, those are just day-to-day tools for 98% of the Western world.
You know,
world,
they're downloading, right? VPNs, right? And they're connecting. You know, yeah, they're doing all this stuff.
Like, well, maybe, you know, but that, I mean, that's a little more advanced. But like, the, you know, word processing, email, searching Google, using basic internet things is just table stakes for most jobs at this point, right? And I think you're right. I think in 5 or 10 years, you know, or maybe even faster than that, a little bit, things like, I'm going to build a little bit of software to generate that report, because I want to show my boss this report in this fashion, much like people have gotten really good at Excel, they're going to be able to do that, but against, you know, the data warehouse, without necessarily having to have somebody like us, give them the data or massage it in some way. There's just going to be, they have a read-only connection to the data warehouse, and they're going to play with Claude until they get the answers they want. And I think that's going to become day-to-day business.
Which stuff. Unlocks, you know, who knows what. But yeah, good stuff.
Yeah. Well, and also it frees us up to do higher value stuff, right? Like, I mean, there's a lot of times where I'm spending 30 minutes to just get somebody data in a CSV in the way they need to consume it. That's a one-off. This is now a feature in the product and I never have to do it again, but it's this one weird scenario where they need, you know, this certain data for this certain time range because of this certain bug or situation or whatever happened. And, you know, I'm the one with the quick, easy access and I can do it in 30 minutes.
It's an awful expensive way to generate a bit of CSV, right? If you look at it objectively.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Frank, we're close to that time in the show where I have to hand you the magic wand and tell you, change something in Django. What would it be?
Ooh, I probably should have thought about this.
anything goes. This is something. And I mean, we'll put aside your steering council hat, all of the hats that you've worn. It could be something trivial, but
this is an idea I've had for a long time, and I think that we may want to spend a bit of time focused on a couple of very specific performance use case things, and specifically caching the user model as part of the sessions and auth system. Not just caching the session, but caching the whole user model. Because in most businessy apps, you're always logged in. And you are doing that database query on every single page, every single API view. And removing that sometimes removes a third of the database queries on that page, right? And it's fast and it's fine. But like, I think if we had a backend that was the auth backend that was more like CacheDB for sessions, I think we would gain, you know, 10% closer parity to faster web frameworks with that one little bit.
It'd be nice if Django could brag about a performance win for a change too, right? As everyone else does with synthetic benchmarks and all the rest. I'm sorry, Carlton, but it's true. It would be nice.
You're going to fire me up now. You're going to fire me up now. Like, okay, so let's compare the Django example where you haven't optimized at all and you've not brought in caching and you're pulling the user model everywhere, and let's strip it out so it's equivalent to the others, and then let's see how fast base handler is compared to your whatever handler you've got. Oh, they're more or less the same. Why? Because they're doing the same thing. Oh, sorry. Get so cross.
I mean, plus or minus a couple of function calls, like they're very, very similar in the core. Yeah, no, absolutely. And but I'm also obviously, you know, often surprised at like the performance differences between things. It's really hard. Like I would like to think I have a really great kind of sense for such things, but I would not have guessed the level of impact that Pydantic for serialization would have had to your average Django REST API. Right. I mean, that's Ninja's secret sauce there for me, is nested serializers in Ninja are damn near free, right? Where they're terribly expensive in DRF. And so we avoid them in most of our projects because they're fairly expensive. And, you know, it's like your API goes from 100 milliseconds to 600 milliseconds and just doing something nested. And that's with select related, prefetch related, all taken care of, like just as best as I can optimize it, it's still slower. And you just switch over to use Pydantic for your serializer and you gain hundreds of milliseconds, and that, you know, users feel that and it scales better and you save on cloud costs and there's knock-on effects of all that.
I mean, it's the modern serialization. It's Pydantic, Atas and Katas, Message Spec, like these options, they're just a world apart from, you know, the field space approach that we had a decade ago.
I'm just shedding a quiet tear because I just finished finally the 5x update to my Django's for APIs book, which is focused on Django REST framework. And I'm well aware that the next update for 6, whatever, will have to include Ninja or maybe just do it all in Ninja because that is where things are going.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think anybody really goes wrong using DRF, right? Like, but I don't think that, like, for me, often, and it's my situation, it's not everybody's situation, but for me, performance often matters, right? Like a lot of this stuff that we do is at pretty high scale. And so I have not started an API project with not Ninja after I started one with Ninja, right? And so I don't think I'll be starting a new DRF project, but there are situations where I would, right? If we're working with a team that has long and deep DRF experience and they don't have a huge performance concern, it's internal tooling or something, like they have modest performance needs and they're very comfortable with DRF, I'm not going to make that whole team learn a new thing unless they want to, right? Like, I'm not going to be like, no, you must. Like, there's, you know, this is the only acceptable answer. It's more nuanced than that. And that's, I think, true of everything, right? Like, if I consult with a company and they have deep, deep JavaScript expertise and everything's built in Express and everything's pretty much working, I don't try to switch them over to Django. I help them with their performance issue and we move on. And, you know, we might, you know, rib each other a little bit about our choices of frameworks and, you know, and all good fun. But, like, you know, the right tool for me is not always the right tool for you, especially when it's a large company.
I can't think of wiser words to finish on than those.
Absolutely. So, Frank, thank you again for coming on. Thank you. We've had a run here of steering council people. We've had Emma, Lily, Frank. The only one we're missing is Tim recently, though we've had...
Tim just before Christmas, though. So, you know...
That's true.
Frank hasn't been on for 5 years, so we're allowed to get him back.
It's been that long.
Yeah, we've been doing this for six. We've been doing this for 6 years. So, yeah.
Wow.
Well... Thank you for taking the time, Frank. We will have links to all those things. People should try out your projects.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, guys. And I'll see you again in 5 years.
You'll see me in five years. You'll see Carlton in a month for his, or a week for the steering council.
Yeah.
But DjangoChat.com and see you ever next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode was sponsored by Hacksoft, your Django development partner beyond code. Learn more about their services in the link in the description.